Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hello and welcome to another episode of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. That second part describes very roughly who I am. The first part describes very roughly what the podcast is about, fringy, edgy topics. And today I've got somebody who's, well, quite a fascinating and very intelligent, eloquent speaker, Frida Wiesel. And she grew up in the Haredi community, the Hasidic Jewish community, in quite an extreme part of it. And one of the reasons I wanted to get Frida on is because I've done some episodes recently, as you guys will probably be aware, with Julia Hart, with Javi Weisberger. Ages ago, there was one with Emily Green. And these were women who left the Hasidic or, you know, ultra-Orthodox community, and had obviously, you know, horrible, horrible experiences and a horrible slant on the whole thing. And understandably so, they had really, really difficult situations. And Frida also left, so she didn't really enjoy it that much either, I suppose. But she has a different perception, and she really respects and admires parts of the community while criticizing others. And I got so much criticism. And this is the hard thing, I suppose, of being a podcaster. You get so much criticism, and then you've got to think, well, am I just getting criticism from people because they're still in a cult, you know? Or is some of it valid? And I think there are differences between things like, you know, Hasidic Judaism and extreme parts of religion and cults. You know, they're not made to pay to get extra information. They're not tricked into joining and things like that. However, the same criticisms from the other episodes, in my mind, they remain valid. I'm talking about the way that women are, in many respects, treated as second-class citizens, although people from the Hasidic community have said, no, they're valued even more because they don't even have to study and stuff like that. And I'm talking about the way that there's so much pressure to marry, to have somebody arranged for you, to not have individual liberty. So we have an interesting discussion, I think, and I have a lot of respect for Frida, and she is a really intelligent person. And she also gives these tour guides in Brooklyn of the old Hasidic community. So she still has one foot in that community, but lives her life very much outside of it. Go and follow her on YouTube and check out. She goes and looks into people's homes and stuff, Hasidic Jewish community, which is very, very hard to get access to. So it's quite a rare glimpse into that life. So go and subscribe. Frida Wiesel. We'll put a link on the in the description. Otherwise, as always, there are loads of big episodes coming up. I'm going to try and mix it up a little bit more in the coming weeks and months. That's the idea. It's been quite cult defector heavy. I'm going to see what else works for my audience, which is you guys. But now you're on the edge of Hasidim or Hasidic Jewish communities with Frida Wiesel. Frida, I love your channel. I love how you present it. I love that you're smart and eloquent and interesting and interested. And it's all interestingly and beautifully filmed as well. So let's get into the history of Frida. What was your childhood like?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Andrew. I'm not quite sure that I can tell the other side of the story. I can try to speak for my own experience, which I also left the Hasidic community. I grew up in Kiryas Joel, which is a Satmar Hasidic enclave. And let me try to paint the world I come from for you. It is a village that is exclusively Satmar Hasidim. I was born there and I lived there the first 25 years of my life. When I was a child, the way it looked, it was all these winding, hilly streets of four family homes. They all looked very similar, but different color siding. And they all had these green lawns and a ton of bikes, trikes, bicycles, scooters, and children playing in the streets at all times. It is an extremely child-centric world because the birth rate is very high and approximately half the population are minors. So all of childhood revolves around children. You step out of your door, there are children playing. You step into your door, there are, of course, your siblings and your siblings' friends. You go to these schools where it feels like everything, every adult's life revolves around raising their own children and raising their neighbors, their siblings' children, you know, helping care for each other and, of course, working in the school systems. So it is a very safe experience. It is a very sheltered experience as well, because secular society is kept out in a very carefully censored system of censoring what's taught in the schools and keeping television and movies out of the homes. So as a child, I knew my world. That's what I knew. I knew my little bubble, the safety of it. We never locked our front door. Never, not even to go to sleep. We were always outside. I was definitely always outside. I was really a wild child. And we had some understanding that there was a world outside of our insular world. But my primary experience as a child was of the world in which I was raised itself and all the politics that came with it, the challenges as well as the charms. You know, that was really what I was oriented towards.
It's so fascinating to hear about, because it's so rare that one gets an insight. I suppose because many of us on the outside, perhaps mistakenly, but we see it as very insular. I sometimes have seen Haredi, I believe, and I'm going to ask you in a bit about the differences between all the words, because no matter how many times I've interviewed people, I still can't seem to remember exactly what means what. But I often saw people, you know, with the hats and the hair on the side, just around North London, and I just always felt like, wow, they're just like another group. If I went and asked them something, maybe they'd be angry at me, and I don't know. I mean, what? Growing up, did you feel, I mean, you spoke about the outside world and you had a vague sense of them. Did you ever interact with any outsiders?
Well, there were instances of interacting with outsiders. If we went to doctor's offices, I remember our dentist was Jewish, but not Orthodox. And I remember how incredibly funny we found it that he said he had a menorah. It was like, how could you have our thing? Because we had such a strong sense of, yeah, of being different, and that the things we observed were unique to us, because it felt like what we did was such an inside world. We spoke a different language. We spoke Yiddish. So there was a sense of, we know these rituals for ourselves and that the outside world didn't participate in them. And when the dentist, who looked like an outsider because he didn't have a beard, his face was shaved and he spoke English, when he said, I have a menorah, you know, I'm Jewish, we had a hard time grasping, well, how's it possible? But you don't look like us. So how could that be? It was, once we found it humorous, but also hard to grasp. But definitely we didn't think, oh, you are not good enough, or that you are, I didn't think so, or that you are evil in any which way. I didn't think so. I just had a really hard time grasping how it was possible that my thing, our menorah, our Shabbos, would apply to this man, the dentist.
That's so funny. I have a similar experience as a, I suppose, as an atheist, secular Jew, whenever I've been to Israel, just for holidays and stuff, that they react to me in that way. Because I think they're surprised to find somebody who's not from Israel and not from New York as well, who is Jewish. And they all start saying, oh, can you read this? And they show me like the back of a Coca-Cola can, and it's like Hebrew writing. And I'm like, well, I can sort of, but I need the vowels, because it doesn't show the vowels, which are like the training blocks on a bicycle, training wheels, you know, just, you're supposed to read it with that. We should say what a menorah is, by the way. And is there a difference between a menorah and a Hanukkah, or is that the same thing?
I think a Hanukkah has maybe fewer arms. A menorah is the candelabra you light on Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a holiday in the winter where for 8 nights you light a menorah, a candelabra with 8 arms, and you add an additional arm every night, starting from 1 going up to 8. Hanukkah, I think maybe has 6. I'm sure the YouTube commenters will correct me. But, or maybe it's the same thing. We call it a menorah.
Okay. And then, so your childhood, would you say it was one filled with happiness and love?
Well, there were parts of it that were very charming and very innocent. And there were parts of it that I found really difficult, especially in my teenage years. My younger years, my mother would call me the Gasin Ying, which is a street child. I was always up to something, you know, sweating. I was this freckled kid running around, always, you know, setting up a game of this or that or a mock wedding. As I matured, I started to struggle. I think, first of all, when something was forbidden, I needed to know what it was. You know, I was always that kind of kid. Mm-hmm. There are these kids who are so serious. You're told, don't look at this, and they don't look. And then there are the kids who you tell them, don't look at this, and they're like, what? Now I have to see. And I was definitely that kind of kid. But I also experienced, as we came into womanhood in our teenage years, I started to have a really hard time sometimes with a sense of maybe exclusion from male spheres, which I felt was in some ways maybe the better world, the better side of things. So we were very gender segregated. We went to girls only schools, and at some age, definitely well before 10, we started to play separately in the streets, the boys and the girls. And with time, that separation became more and more defined, so that at weddings, we would be separate, and at parties, we would be separate. And the female realm was a very busy world of its own. I had a lot of friends. I had, we were always outside in the streets with neighbors talking, but I had a sense, let's say you go to a wedding, sometimes you see the women, the dancing is a little more restrained. There's a kind of a modesty, and then the men are, they're drinking, and there's a little, you know, really release. And I would always look to the men's side and think, you know, that they seem to be having the better deal of it. You know, I wish I could be on that side of things. I did feel a sense of exclusion that would sometimes make me very upset, and that I had a hard time talking myself down from, that I found most of my friends couldn't even begin to grasp why I would care. Why would you want anything to do with these sweaty boys? Why would you want to be a part of their extremely, extremely challenging education system, which demands of them hours and hours of studying? And I do understand where they were coming from, but I think I naturally have an aversion to the sense of exclusion. And that was a part of what colored my childhood. But I would say, you know, it's easy to go back in hindsight and retell our stories and talk about the things that led us on the path that we're on, or to try to find things that led us on that path, because ultimately I left. But what I will say is I definitely never, ever imagined I would leave. And I never thought, well, I feel so frustrated by my role in this community, I want to leave. There were these little ways in which I rubbed against the edges. I'm a very independent-minded person, but I'm not the only person to not be a conformist, to not fit into a mold, to need to march to my own beat. And a lot of people make it work in the community. So I don't know to which degree going back and looking at these differences is revisionist history, and to which degree I didn't fit in, and to which degree you could have looked at me as a 12-year-old and said, this one is not going to stay.
And I suppose you must feel a certain degree of pressure in describing it, because, I mean, it's just a fact that there is a lot of anti-Semitism. A lot of it is directed towards the Haredi communities. I believe that statistically they, or Jews in general, are the most discriminated against pro rata minority in America and the UK, as in per person. Is that on your mind, you know, on your channel? Do you have to worry about that talking too disparagingly about the Haredi community might encourage more attacks?
No, to be honest, I don't. I don't think about anti-Semitism, although maybe it's something I should be thinking about. Maybe it's valid. I do think there is a concern about anti-Semitism, but my own focus on measuring carefully what I say, which I do, doesn't come out of a concern about anti-Semitism. Again, not because it's not a valid concern, but because I come from a place of feeling like, in order for us to come from the outside, looking into a completely different world, we have to try to contextualize it. if we're going to look at the most out there elements of a different society, then we'll never grasp what makes it like us, what makes it human, what makes it relatable. You know, if we're going to list off the things that strike us as most different, we'll end up calling it a cult, ultimately. And what I feel very passionately about is understanding differences while also being able to connect what makes it human, to be able to see, well, this is completely different and maybe I would never, ever fit into it. But I do get its charms and I do get what it has to offer and what it has to offer that our society doesn't offer. And that's really where I'm coming from. My hope is to create a humanizing portrait. And if I will say, in my childhood, I didn't like being a woman, I wished I could be a boy, then I feel like the viewer gets very hung up on that. And it is true to me, you know, it is my story, but I'm not really so interested in talking about my own journey as much as I'm interested in understanding what makes it tick for the people in the community who live this life, you know, from birth to the end of it, and who fascinate me so much because on an intuitive level, I appreciate what makes it work. But there is a part of me that never grasps it. And that's the draw for me.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
You talk about, I suppose, well, you mentioned the word cult, and I guess this is, I'm learning with every episode I do about these things, and I suppose the difference between a traditional religion and a cult, in Hasidic Judaism, you don't have this like one overarching leader that you do get with Scientology, the founder, then the leader, who is in charge of the rules for everybody, and everybody has to obey them. I imagine... Am I right in saying that there will be different levels of, severity or devoutness among different parts of the Haredi communities?
Yeah. Let me try to explain to you the sort of a little bit of the nuances. Haredi is now the term we use for ultra-Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox is deemed offensive, so we use the word Haredi. But it's synonymous with what we might say is ultra-Orthodox. It is the umbrella term for Orthodox Jews of various kinds of, degrees of insularity. And there are some Orthodox Jews that might not be as insular. For instance, they might speak English. In the yeshivish community, which is non-Hasidic, generally the first language is English. So they're not as closed off from the outside world because they speak the language of the land. So depending on the subset of Haredi Judaism, we see various degrees of insularity. And where I grew up in Kiryas Joel, this enclave of Satmar Hasidim, I could say it's one of the most insular pockets of Haredi Judaism. Hasidic Jews generally are more insular than just yeshivish or regular Orthodox Jews. And within Hasidic Judaism, there are sects. The word sect here is not used as cult. It's used as in groups, subgroups, right? So we have these different subgroups that all are at the head. They will have a Rebbe. But the Rebbe is a figurehead. He's a little bit like royalty. He's like the British royalties. Serves as a dignitary of important functions and someone you go to for blessings. But he doesn't mind your business. He doesn't come to your house and say, why do you have a TV or something like that? Might be portrayed in movies. He's the head of a dynasty that could sometimes be very big. The Satmar dynasty is huge. And some of the sects are considered more modern or more open, more likely to speak English, more likely to learn more secular subjects, more likely to be okay with college education than other sects. I think the Satmar sect is one of the most insular. And as we move to different sects, like Babov is considered more modern. And once we move outside of the umbrella of Hasidism and we're still under the umbrella of Haredi Judaism, we start to get to more and more openness to the outside world. Just if you take, for instance, dating practices, the more open it is, the more it's going to resemble Western dating practices. More dates, more deliberation, more emphasis on what the couple wants to do to go ahead in terms of, are they ready for marriage? And as you move towards more insularity, you also move towards a more old school, traditional dating, marriage making system with a matchmaker, fewer dates, fewer emphasis on the child making the decision. So if you really want to understand Hasidic Jews or Orthodox Jews, I think it's important to try to place everyone in context, or at least that's what I always do. Where do you come from? Let me try to understand the world that you come from first, and then I can understand your engagement with the outside world.
That's fascinating. And so, where were you on that spectrum, your childhood?
So I also didn't answer your question about cults, which I think we asked, right? So I was the Satmar sect. I was born into the Satmar sect. The Satmar sect is very much in the closed off end of the spectrum. I didn't grow up knowing about a public library. I didn't grow up with a TV. Now I give tours in Satmar, in Williamsburg, which is largest sect there is the Satmar sect. And you see very few smartphones, mostly only flip phones, because they are the smartphone culture, something that the community is trying to shut out. Very traditional clothing. So if you see the side locks and you see women in head coverings, that's the Satmar sect that I come from and my entire family is in.
So is that not, I mean, obviously you've done very well out of it, but in general, I guess that's, I'm just trying to think if that's a handicap for someone to be brought up that way if they want to then move into the outside world.
Yeah, it is. And the emphasis of bringing up children in this community is to keep them in this way of life. You know, the community makes no apologies about trying to battle with a very powerful secular dominant culture and retain its distinct way of life. And if it was bleeding its children into a secular society, I think its way of life would not be able to stay as it is, right? So there is an intentional effort to keep the children in by keeping them sheltered from the outside world, which by definition doesn't prepare you then to go on and leave. There are so many handicaps that come from growing up in this community if you want to leave. It's just by the very definition that you haven't been socialized to participate in secular society. Just as if you, Andrew, decide to join the Hasidic community, you would be enormously handicapped. That's just the very obvious outcome of having a parallel culture to secular culture.
Some of the ways that you describe this in terms of keeping people, you know, from being in the outside world, which they have to do, I suppose, to an extent, those are, I suppose, would you say, the cultish elements inside the religion?
I suppose I hear that question. I have put this before other people as well. What does it mean to not offer the option of an alternative life? I wouldn't call it a cult because a society raises its children to not leave. I think for me, the concept of a cult is specifically, it has a certain flavor of the zeal of the convert, of someone who is not born into it. They pick it. And although there are cults that people are born into, that's what I think of when we think of a cult. And of course, we can go into defining it. But just keeping children in a particular society, I think I can see how it is necessary in order to keep a way of life alive. That's how I would frame the answer. For instance, there are many towns in the middle of the United States that have issues of bleeding its talents that go, you know, the young people, the talented people go to the city, they look for a better life, and it kind of collapses the small town life. If you do everything you can to keep the young in the society remains very vibrant. So should a society try to undermine itself by offering an alternative? Or is it justified for the civic community, the civic society, to try to self-preserve at the cost of not giving the option of leaving?
It's, I guess what you're talking about is the battle between individualism and collectivism. I've heard it said that in some communist countries or countries with a communist background, at least, or heritage, such as China, when they'll look at a photo, they'll describe like the background of the photo. Whereas in, you know, I think America is maybe one of the most individualistic, as the UK is, societies in the world. And we will describe the people or the one person in particular at the, in the front of the photo. And so for an individualist, I suppose that kind of community sounds scary because it's like, okay, maybe we want to uphold that community, but by doing so, we're impinging upon the freedom of the individual who wants to move to the city. But then the collectivist would say, like, hey, but the community comes first. That's more important because without communities, the individuals don't have communities to go to.
I think you can frame it that way. You can also frame it, I think this is how the Hasidic community frames it, that ultimately there is inherent reward in sticking with a collective or sticking with what's seen as right and God-fearing proper way, that there is a reward to the individual down the line. There's a lot of that narrative I get from people. Well, maybe when you're younger, it's easier to find, you know, be out there. But down the line, you know, it's there is a return on your investment if you stay in the community, which I suppose might be true for some people. It's not necessarily, I'm sure, true for everyone. And there's, of course, also the part of the afterlife, where if you believe in an afterlife, especially as it's taught in the Hasidic community, then there's the element of you as an individual will benefit most in sticking to this way of life because then you will have a wonderful afterlife.
Did you grow up speaking English?
No, Yiddish is my first language.
Kannst du Deutsch verstehen?
Ich verstehe Deutsch, ja, ein bisschen.
Wir können eine Unterhaltung auf Deutsch haben.
Yeah,
ich habe in Deutschland gewohnt. I lived in Germany for a couple of years.
And
wanted to learn. And I'm always fascinated. But the thing is, obviously, in the past, whenever I've spoken to people who've been in Haredi communities, because so far they've given me such traumatic stories of abuse and things like that, it hasn't felt appropriate for me to start showing off my German languages and trying to test if I can have a conversation with somebody who speaks Yiddish. So that was the first time I've tried that. And it's good to know that it worked, I think, right?
I think it worked. I understood you. Ich hab in Deutschland gewohnt. Is that how you said it?
Yeah, ich habe in Deutschland gewohnt.
Gewohnt, okay. We say it a little differently, but it's quite so. Yiddish and German are quite, there's a lot that you can pick up.
I find that so fascinating. And then I gather that the girls usually speak a little bit better English because they're doing a lot of the working and things like that and groceries and stuff.
And not quite. It has to do with the curriculum in the schools. The boys are studying the Torah and the Talmud, and they kind of have a very different culture in their schools. They have a very old school education system where there's a male teacher who will, you know, now they're changing the system a little, but it was a lot more modeled on the one room schoolhouse education system where the teacher would sit in front of a big room of students who would sit against the wall with a table around them. There's the Hebrew letter ches, you must know, since you studied for your bar mitzvah.
I know ches. Chet. Oh, yes, I think I know. Is it like a, it's like a, oh, right, I know what you're saying. It's like an L shape, but with the extra line below the
With the extra line, yeah. I'm trying to explain it to your podcast listeners.
Don't you all speak Hebrew, podcast listeners? Don't you all
I'm
read
so
Hebrew?
I'm so sorry.
No, I know what you mean. Just like a round, a table that goes all the way around, but with, but in a square kind of way.
Yeah, but in a square kind of way. And the, you know, the boys would study for hours on end. The Torah, the Talmud, they would learn to recite, and translate and understand various difficult texts. And there, the enormous amount of emphasis on teaching the boys to study the Torah, which is their gendered responsibility, means that they are in school for very long days and they're essentially only interacting in Yiddish and biblical Hebrew. On the other hand, the girls don't study the Torah. In the gendered roles for women, it's about the domestic realm. So women don't study the Torah. Some sects, as you move towards more open sects, the women become more and more engaged in the men's sphere and those gender segregations get more blurred. But in my world, we didn't study anything directly from the texts, only orally. And as a result of that, we spoke a lot more English because our curriculum was not designed to study holy texts. It was much more designed to be a standard education institution with a half a day of learning religious subjects and a half a day secular subjects. So from grade one, we had a teacher who came in and spoke to us in English. And that continued all the way until I graduated at 11th grade. And by 11th grade, I was fairly fluent in English, while my brothers, who were about the same age, would have struggled enormously with English. So it's not really to do with who's going to do the work in the Satmar sect. The men are actually the breadwinners on the whole. It really has to do with the emphasis on studying the Torah, which means that the boys end up learning very little English.
I see. So it's so hard to think about it because I guess you... Okay, so tell me this, and I don't want to labor this point if you don't want to talk about it, but I'm just intrigued. Did your parents show you much love and fun as a child? Was that part of your childhood?
I experienced the love I experienced from my mother in particular was especially through her stories. She would tell stories. And we didn't have a lot of stories. We were pretty starved for entertainment. Now there's a lot more Yiddish entertainment, but at the time, you don't watch movies, you don't have television. Stories become a commodity, and my mother is a great storyteller.
So she would sit,
and a good story becomes something that actually my friends, my neighbors would want to participate in. It was something I felt kind of proud of, that, you know, my mother would tell such good stories that everyone would want to hear it. In fact, in summer camp, there was a professional storyteller that would tell stories every Shabbos during the afternoon. We would come to hear stories and she would spin her tales and we'd all be fascinated.
That is fascinating as well, because I'm just imagining what people listening are thinking. And I imagine that most people are going like, okay, this sounds a little bit restrictive and it definitely does impinge upon like liberal freedoms, individual freedoms in many respects, but also how fascinating. And I suppose many of us might be a little envious that oral tradition, which is what we evolved through, telling stories orally, that's still very much alive in parts of the world, particularly in the Haredi communities. How amazing. And, you know, I think of my little sister who's 16 and is just like, you know, since she was a baby, has just been plonked in front of a TV. And how wonderful that idea that she might, you know, sit down and listen to a story, and the imagination and everything that you get from being able to like listen and imagine in your mind. I think many people might be quite envious of that.
Yeah, I think it's an exchange. Do I want to go back to cutting myself off from, let's say, all the books that I read now? I don't. But I also think there is tremendous value in being very judicious in how much you expose children. I think there is a very big plus side. The children in the Hasidic community, to me, seem to exhibit an enormous curiosity that I think is nurtured out of not hypersaturating them with instantly colorful entertainment. Just seeing how much people read tiny texts in the newspapers, I do think it's the other side of what you said, Andrew. Yes, it is restrictive. There is no doubt it is very restrictive. And I found it too restrictive for me. And I didn't like sneaking around as a way of getting around the restrictions. But on the other hand, I think there is a reward to it. And that's really where I come from at this. I think every culture, assuming it's a healthy culture, will make exchanges. Maybe it's restrictive on the one hand, but if we can understand that there is another side to it, do we really benefit so much from having the TVs in our homes? Personally, I don't have a TV, so you know where I stand on that.
That goes back to that philosophical question about like arranged marriages. I've read that people, that divorce rates are lower in arranged marriages. I don't know if that tells us all that much, because I suppose the very people who entered into arranged marriages might also feel that pressure to stay together. But I think satisfaction is also better. And these are things, I'm definitely an individualist and I cherish, for me, it's all about individual freedom. But I can see that some people would thrive in a community like that. I suppose the issue is for the ones that want to get out and feel like they can't. So how was getting out of there for you? When did that start to enter your mind as even a possibility?
I started to realize that my place in the community was in jeopardy, I would put it that way, when I was maybe a young mother. And I was starting to have a harder and harder time with certain elements that I felt I needed to hide or I needed to conform with. And eventually, I didn't want to participate in some of the restrictions, or I wanted to move to a more liberal community. And I didn't think of it as in, I'm going to leave. I thought of it in terms of, I want to move with my husband and my baby to a more liberal community where we can have a little more of both worlds. We can have maybe a more secular exposure, adopt a lot more elements of Western society, but not alienate my family and his family, and to remain sort of in good standing. I'm not a person who likes big wars and fights, and I couldn't even imagine tearing myself away from this world. Unfortunately, my husband didn't want to. He was adamant that he would stay in the most insular of the South Merced. And I was heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken. We went repeatedly to therapy, and he was, you know, I was 18. My parents picked him. I was extremely, obviously young, but also I was very nervous about getting married. And he was sweet to me. I felt myself blossoming in that marriage. And then when he was like, well, this is the line. If you want to not observe these things, then I cannot go along with it. I was so angry. I was so, so incredibly hurt. I was also very, very upset that there were people in the community that would participate in the breaking of a marriage because they would want to, you know, that maybe meddle, or because they were so strong-minded about certain things. Now, not everyone. There's definitely people in the community who will say, you've got to prioritize the marriage. But ultimately, I suppose it was for the best, because I am a very nonconformist person, and I don't know how it would have gone down if I had gotten my way. But he left the marriage. At some point, he said, I can't live like this. I don't want to, you know, live the life that you seem to really want to live. And he left the marriage. And I went through, I knew already that there were people who lose custody when they are not in good standing in the community. And I went through a period of tremendous fear that the power imbalance that I was facing would lead to me losing custody. I was in a very vulnerable place. I didn't have any of the enormous support systems that he had. This is the thing. When you're in good standing in this community, you're cocooned. You're in a very supportive place. But the moment you step to the other side, you see a very different side of things. You start to see the other side. You know, he's the one who's cocooned, and you're the one who needs to deal with not having the financial and social support to deal with a custody battle. It's a little bit like fighting for custody with a very, very wealthy party that has all of the legal system on their side. But there is an added element that the children will often be socialized in the community, and therefore the court system will see it in the interest of the children to stay in the world that they've been socialized in and where they have their extended family in. And this made me very, very nervous about, I went through a period of being absolutely terrified that I would lose custody of my son, which thankfully, very, very thankfully, didn't happen. There were a couple of scares where I thought the wolf was waking and people would start to turn on me, but it didn't happen. Sort of at some point, my son stayed living with me. And at some point, people got tired of gossiping about me and talking about, is she running off with Pence? Is this the next big scandal? And I was very fortunate that the experience Javi had where she was fighting in the legal system didn't happen for me. So I ended up just moving out. I lived in a modern Orthodox community for a couple of years where I felt entirely outside of my element culturally. It's a very upper class American, it wasn't a place for a single mom without any education, or at least that's how I felt. And I then ended up moving to the city where I live now.
Were there support groups like, Footsteps is a big one that helps people to move out of the Haredi communities?
Were there support groups? There were some. No support group is going to correct the imbalance that happens when your entire world, your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, your siblings, your parents, they all watch you embark on a journey that they feel is absolutely detrimental, that is scandalous, that is painful. Ultimately, that's something that if you go through with that journey, you, I think no support system can rectify the tremendous loss. And also the disadvantage that you're at if you're dealing with a custody issue.
And how was it with your parents? Were you able to sort of continue going over, say, for Friday night dinner or something?
My family never disowned me, but they were very devastated. And for a while, my mother would be very, very, very obviously distraught. I remember running into my brother in the streets. Sweetheart, my brother. And he said, "I feel so bad for mommy," which is often the emphasis on feeling empathy to the parents, but not the person who's leaving. You know, the community can very much connect to the painful experience of the parents who are losing a child, but having a very hard time imagining the position that the person who's leaving is in. And that was something I experienced with my mother for quite a while until kind of our relationship slowly morphed into a place where, with time, she became more and more comfortable talking about my life and my son's life in a way that is very foreign to her. You know, she has a hard time connecting to the experience that I have as a parent and that my son has in the world. But my parents, especially my mother, they've really tried in their own way once things died down to be there. And I'm always invited. I'm constantly invited. And when they invite me, they do everything they can to make me comfortable. You know, they find me an apartment away, like a couple of houses away from where they live, even though they have a ton of room, because they want to give me sort of the privacy. Do what you want. Don't feel like we're watching you kind of thing. It's sweet. But they're, you know, I live a very different world that I think I don't expect my parents and my family to ever understand.
It sounds like in some respects, is it fair to say, compared to others who have left, your experience was fairly mild compared to maybe Javi, where she felt like shunned by everyone. And had you had an experience like that, do you think you might look back on the community a little differently?
Well, no, there were some people who were very, very cruel to me in the process of leaving. And I hold hard feelings against people who I had lovely relationships with, and my relationships were changed by the fact that I thought they would at least not abandon me. I definitely felt abandoned in the process of leaving. And it hurts. It's something that even though it's many years later, I went through a period at the time of, I remember being in such agony over the abandonment of people who I understood that they were under social pressure or they were very afraid of getting mixed up in things, similar to what Javi was describing in her friend group. But the interesting journey for me has been that some relationships were harmed. Other relationships were strengthened in my journey of leaving. And then other relationships were changed, like with my family. But I also became a tour guide in the neighborhood. And I tried to sort of keep a distance as an outsider. But since I've been doing YouTube videos, I walk around the neighborhood and I've become a recognized face. Officially, you're not supposed to be on the internet in the city community, or at least on the unfiltered internet.
But they know you.
But everyone knows me. Somehow, everyone knows me. Yeah. I walk the street and I went from, you know, I've been doing this 10 years. I've been a tour guide 10 years, nine of which I was completely under the radar. No one knew who I was. No, like very rarely would I see someone say, you know who she is? So-and-so's daughter. This is so-and-so's daughter. But usually people would have no idea who I was because I would try not to give it away as much as possible. And since I've been doing YouTube videos, I've kind of become noticed. And my expectation was that I would get negative attention, that people would not like it. And the reaction has been largely for people to make no comments on my own journey, which I have tremendously appreciated. People don't say, well, why don't you come back to Hashem? Or you'll end up regretting. I have gotten none of that, which I really thought that would happen. People would start to lecture me. Nothing. Even though I go to the community wearing pants. Of course, a woman is not supposed to wear pants. It's men's garment. I wear pants. I feel like I don't want to go to the community under these enormous false pretenses. And I expect a consequence of that to be some people to reproach me. I'm not getting that at all, which has framed a new kind of relationship with this community that I find to be very sweet and very charming. And I feel maybe a modicum of acceptance. I don't know. I don't know if it's going to last.
Hey, pants is a really interesting thing, and or trousers for British people listening, of course, although we know pants, but or jeans. Firstly, because I had this, my first interview with Emily Green, she talked about when she first came out of the community, she tried to get a job and she went to an interview wearing just jeans and she didn't know why she didn't get it. And they said, because you would not dress smartly enough. And it blew her mind that there was this difference in smartness between jeans and like suit trousers or whatever it might be, because it's just totally different symbols that we all have for things. And that's really interesting. And then also the first episode of Julia Hart's My Unorthodox Life, there's this scene where her daughter walks in wearing jeans to see her husband, who has just left with them, but he's a lot more nervous about the whole thing. And he just like loses his mind over it, that you're wearing jeans. And what's really funny about that is that scene, she's got like a very sort of loosely fitted top that is like, yeah, like you can basically, she's almost naked from like chest up. And that didn't seem to be the problem. The problem was the jeans that were covering her waist down to her shoes. What is the thing with jeans?
Sometimes it's more about you have these kinds of barriers or these lines that you draw. I don't know if you can relate to it. Sometimes you're like on a diet and you say, I'm not going to eat X thing. And you'll eat crazy healthy, unhealthy, but you'll keep that line. And jeans is a line. Sometimes it isn't entirely logical, but there is, though, an element to jeans that is problematic on top of modesty, and that is that it's a men's garment. So women are not supposed to wear men's garments and vice versa. So it's really about the symbolism of a woman wearing men's clothing.
He was seeing her, like if my girlfriend came home and saw me wearing a dress, it was just like, it was like an additional strange, the genders. I just thought about modesty and I thought, why the jeans and not the top? But I get it. I get it now.
I don't think it was for him about beg a dish, which is not wearing the clothing of a man. I think for him, it was simply, we're still a little bit part of the world that I know, that I'm familiar with. and you have now given up the last shred of connection. And that's how I heard it. And I'm not ready to let go. You know, visiting my family and being a part of certain ceremonies that are very important, you feel like you haven't let go entirely of where you come from. It's a traumatic experience to go from an intense culture to a completely new one. I find it very healthy to hold on to both, you know, to find a way to be able to celebrate both. I mean, to each its own. But I sympathized with him in not wanting to sever that thread that connected him to the world that he comes from. And I understood where he came from. I didn't think it was... The idea of pants is based on beggar-ish and not wearing men's clothing, but it wasn't really that per se that I think he was reacting to.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that. Like, you've left apart. There's just this one thread that still connects you to your old life. And I think we get that. I haven't actually asked you about your arranged marriage. We talked about you leaving and that he wouldn't come with you and that your parents arranged it. So how does that work?
Well, I got married in the shidduch system, which is essentially all the students at 18 from my girls' school get eligible for marriage so long as they don't have older siblings. Generally, it goes in order of age, unless there's extenuating circumstances. So usually when you're 18, you become of age and matchmakers will start to call the parents proposed matches. And my parents set up my match. I found out my parents are very old school. So they believe that a match is made in heaven and they're just God's messengers. And as long as you try to do your share and you don't try to take too much, meddling into the process, but also you don't, abandon the process, the rest is sort of fate driving the match. I was so nervous about the entire process of getting engaged. Actually, the biggest issue in my engagement was there were all these nuances of degrees of religiosity, even in Kiryas Joel, which is supposed to be the most of the extremes of the insular. There were all these differences. How long is the side curls? The kinds of glasses a man wears, the kinds of hats. And I kind of thought, since I was always a little bit of a troublemaker and a handful, and I was always like, I was not a good kid by the definition of a good kid. And I loved to gravitate to the forbidden. I thought my parents would pick someone who would be like me, and they actually didn't. When he came into the room, I thought he was too conservative for me. And that made me so nervous. But you know, the irony is that he ended up not being my first impression of him as being almost a zealot because he was wearing certain glasses was not a correct read. He was fairly open-minded. And, you know, when we got married, he would give me little gifts from the library, from the bookstore he would buy me. I was over the moon. I was so happy about that, that he was open, that he wasn't a rigid person, that he wasn't the kind of husband who is constantly, you know, making rules for himself, which I thought I wouldn't be able to connect to. So it ended up being, you know, it wasn't how I experienced it on the meeting, but that one meeting I had definitely gave me a lot of, I was a very nervous bride.
Was he quite handsome? Were you physically attracted to him?
I don't think I knew really about attraction. I thought he was cute. I was very, very concerned about him not putting limitations on me, you know, not getting married to a man who is constantly so consumed with religiosity. There are these kinds, the zealots. That was something I was very concerned about. He was very handsome looking. He was all right.
And then, and again, you know, let me know if you don't want to talk about this, but the thing that people talk about is the wedding night. The people I've spoken to before have described it as feeling like a rape because they feel culturally coerced into having sex regardless of whether they want to or not. How was your experience?
I did see your video with Emily where she talks about it that way. I wouldn't describe my experience as rape at all. I think I do understand that, you know, first sexual encounters could be traumatic in the community, outside the community. Sexual encounters can be traumatic. It doesn't make it rape per se. I'm not taking issue with what Emily said. It's her experience. I think the process of preparing two people of the same age to have an intimate life together in a culture that expects them to be intimate after marriage, I don't think that's surprising, is it? I mean, how else? The whole idea of extensive consent and all of that is a very Western concept. If you arrange a marriage, then there's going to be intimacy, right? What?
Oh, it depends on who you ask and how their marriage has been going, but you'd like to hope so. And I see what you're saying. I suppose the implication in that sort of Western society is, yes, there's going to be intimacy, but there doesn't have to be, and that the wife or husband could say, and this does happen frequently, you know, I'm not feeling in the mood for it, or I'm having a few months that are really stressful. And also, on top of that, there's that's the consent in the moment, but also they've chosen to be with one another rather than the society choosing for them to be together and expecting that sex on the wedding night. So it does sound like there's less consent in this version of things, but it's also something that it's just out of my it's something very different.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a good question because the whole concept of consent, I think, is the way we frame it is probably very influenced by our Western values of communicating to each other and I don't think in the Hasidic community. You know, I'm just not going to answer that question because it's really hard for me to articulate the difference between a society that says, well, you get married, now you're going to have sex, and rape. It seems to me that the difference is a value judgment. If you get married, you probably will have sex, no?
I think it is a value judgment. And I suppose so for Emily, according to her values, she saw that as rape, and you might not. And I think that's important that we have that kind of plurality of opinion. Everybody's an individual who feels differently about things. I suppose just the only issue for me is that I guess this is something that Julia said, which was that a lot of people are very happy with the situation in the Haredi communities. A lot of the women are happy growing up that way, but a lot of the women were also against getting the vote, for example, in America, you know, back in the early 1900s. But the point, she says, is not about them. It's about the freedom to choose.
You know, the freedom to choose is also a very Western value. The idea that we have all of these options, that is a choice we make as a society itself. The choice to have choices. Some people might say they prefer a world where they don't have to deal with a constant onslaught of options, right? Julia suggests the freedom to choose. I can see how my parents, believing that there is one right way, that there is one way that leads on the right path, would think choices are to the detriment of the individual. I can see it both ways. I personally prefer a life where I do have choices simply because I don't connect to the oneness of my parents' philosophy. I think there are several ways that different people can interpret the world, and you should be able to find your own path. But that's because I don't think there's one right way.
Well, that's completely fair enough. Frida, you've been brilliant. We've got to the end of the hour, and there's even stuff I wanted to ask that I've written down that I didn't even get to ask about, such as some of your most popular videos about how finances work in the Haredi world, and how there's the stuff of the shaving the head and all these fascinating parts of the culture. So I might have to try and convince you to come on another time at some point. But thank you so much. And tell my viewers why they should go check out your brilliant channel.
Oh, thank you, Andrew, for the conversation. I hope that all of you on YouTube, lovely people, will jump over to my channel where I have different people from the Hasidic community sharing their perspective on the world. And I also talk about different elements of the culture. If you want to kind of see a different side of the story that's usually told about the Hasidic community.
Thank you, Frida Wiesel, for coming on the podcast, for being on The Edge. She's a fantastic guest. And I'm always amazed, the people that come out of the Hasidic Jewish community are always so intelligent and so well-spoken. And we forget often that English is their second language. And obviously, they've grown up in and around English language and culture and things like that. But it's remarkable how well they are able to put their ideas together and how intelligent these people tend to be. That's just my anecdotal experience of defectors from the Hasidic community. She's really interesting, obviously has very different views on things like consent and individual liberty to what I have and to what many listeners will have. Many might be appalled, many might, on the other hand, you know, understand what she's getting at. We need to have plurality of opinion. Let me know what you think. You know, follow on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, On The Edge with Andrew Gold. There's a TikTok as well. And patreon.com/AndrewGold to support the podcast, to get the Saturday episodes as well. And make sure to follow Frida Wiesel. There'll be a link in the description. She's got a fantastic YouTube channel. That's all for now, but I'll be seeing you very soon on The Edge.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.